Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Run Brooks Show, to our news briefing. Today we're going to cover a few topics. I want to talk about General Electric. Sounds boring. Hopefully I'll be able to make it interesting. But General Electric, and it's an interesting case study in what happens in a regulated environment. What happens with cronyism? What happens to a great American company when it shifts from focusing on producing to focusing on manipulating politics? We'll talk about Turkey in the news constantly around the Syria issue. Is Turkey an ally? Is it a friend? Is it an enemy? What's going on with Turkey? It seems to be getting close to Iran. Does that make any sense? How does that work? We'll talk about that. I want to talk a little bit. I don't know a lot about this, but it seems kind of weird and interesting. And maybe some of you can enlighten me, and maybe we can learn more about this. Biohacking. I don't know if you've heard about biohacking. It's anyway, we'll talk about biohacking, gender equality, and STEM. You know, you remember that memo by that Google guy about women in programming? Well, there's a new study out on women in STEM, and it's interesting. Now, I will give this caveat when we talk about the study, but I haven't looked at the data. I warn everybody about these kind of studies. You have to really look at the data. You have to make sure that the analysis really makes sense. I'm going to give you the results, assuming it's all true. But I'll let you be the judges. And maybe at some point we'll delve deeper into the study and look at the actual numbers. And then finally, just a Trump administration wants to raise the gas tax or some kind of transportation tax. We'll talk about that in order to fund the great infrastructure projects of this administration. All right, so we got a pretty full program. If we have time at the end, I will take questions. We've got an open phone line, and I'll also look at the comment section, although it looks pretty thin today, particularly on YouTube, which usually is exploding. It usually takes people in YouTube by 5-10 minutes to warm up before they just go nuts on online. All right, I want to talk about GE. Because GE's this amazing, interesting, fascinating company. And I used to teach GE as an example of one of the few conglomerates in American history to be successful. So if you know what a conglomerate is a business made up of business units that do lots of different types of things. So GE is typically, those of us in business, those of us in finance, frown upon conglomerates. Conglomerates don't work. It's very hard to be really, really good at one thing. A conglomerate needs to be good at lots of things. General Electric used to have a finance arm. It used to do nuclear power plants. It built airplane engines. It, of course, makes refrigerators. And probably another dozen different things that General Electric actually used to make. So it was a classical conglomerate. And there was a period in American history in the 1960s where it was very, very popular to become a conglomerate. In those days, and you're going to get a quick history lesson in American business. I think this is interesting. In those days, CEOs were compensated a lot of time based on sales, based on the size, if you will, of the company, the size of sales, the size of the assets of the company. So they had a strong incentive to buy up everybody in sight. And it wasn't about whether they were maximizing shareholder wealth. It wasn't about whether, because they didn't have options and they weren't getting stocks. So managers of companies during the 1960s and 70s owned very little stock in the companies they managed. They had no options. And what they got compensated was on all kinds of bonus schemes related to sales, related to asset growth, related to profits. But profits from an accounting perspective that can easily be manipulated. And as a consequence, CEOs were incentivized to grow the business for the sake of growing the business. And they bought up, they created conglomerates. And if you look at American business, the largest American businesses in the 1970s were all conglomerates. They were all these massive businesses with lots of business units building lots of different things and not really specializing at all. Not specializing at all. So diversification. Now, the other benefit to managers of diversification is it reduces risk. If one business unit does well or does poorly, it's likely that another business unit in a completely different sector is doing okay. So you average out. You don't get spectacular performance, but you lower risk and you average out over time your performance. You get stability. And again, a lot of these managers were not compensated very highly. They were not compensated with stock. They were not compensated with options. They weren't looking to maximize shareholder wealth. They were looking to maximize their own wealth over time. And that, because of the way compensation was structured, deviated from what was good for the shareholders. Now, all of this, I have to note, was not a product of capitalism. It was not a product of free markets. All of this was a product of regulation, of controls, primarily regulation that were put in place on American businesses during the 1930s that basically restricted how businesses could be run, who could sit on the boards of directors in businesses, and really separated, if you will, the incentives of managers from the incentives of shareholders. And managers were running the businesses not to maximize shareholder wealth. And indeed, this is the period, 1670s, where the American business became uncompetitive globally, became unproductive, inefficient, lost much of its manufacturing capacity and capabilities, and just was starting to fall apart. And of course, this coincided with a horrible period economically for the United States, which was the 1970s, where we got stagflation. Now, it's interesting. Was it that the bad economy in the U.S. caused bad companies, caused low profitability and low stock market returns, or was it the other way around? Well, I think they went together. I think bad economic policy certainly made things worse, but the fact is that these companies were not competitive globally either. You remember when the U.S. used to make televisions? No, most of you probably don't, because that was before the 1980s. When VCRs were made in America? No. And, you know, in those days, the villain of international trade was Japan. And because American companies could not produce very effectively and very productively, all of that was taken over by the Japanese. Now, these conglomerates were inefficient, unproductive, and really destructive to American business and the American economy. And in the 1980s, primarily because of deregulation and because of the genius of Michael Milken and because of the genius or the willingness to take risk on behalf of many kind of financial entrepreneurs during the 1980s, call them hostile takeover artists, many of these conglomerates were broken up because it turned out that they were worth more in pieces because each piece, management could focus on just maximizing the profitability, shareholder value of that piece rather than having to worry about all these other pieces. It takes a rare, genius is maybe too strong a word. It takes a rare talent to be able to run a large company. CEOs, good CEOs, are very, very, very rare. So it takes a rare talent to be able to run one company focused on one thing, on one product well. To be able to manage a company that does 12 different products well is very, very unusual. We'll talk about the one, I think, managerial genius of the last 30, 40, 50 years who managed to pull it off. But that is very, very unusual. So usually what happens is that if you focus just on one thing, you're worth more than if you're part of this conglomerate. So what happened during the 1980s is all these conglomerates got split up, broken up. And as a consequence, we got the economy of the 1990s, which was a much leaner, much more efficient, much more productive, much more creative economy. We saw a massive shift of capital from less effective, less productive industries to much more efficient, much more productive industries. So the whole nature of American economy shifted, changed between the 1960s, 70s into the 80s and 90s. And the change really happened. The decade where the change happened was the 1980s. And the agent of change, more than anybody else, was a guy named Mike Milken. But, you know, there's a long, long story. And if you want to know more about the story, I recommend my latest book, The Wealth Creators, The Mall Case for Finance, where we talk, Don Watkins and I, my co-author, talk a lot about this history, the history of the 1980s and the 1970s, and how financial engineering, financiers, basically reinvented the American corporation. Another innovation that happened during the 1980s is that for the first time really since before the Great Depression, managers were compensated with stock. Now, as it happened, the best way to compensate managers was with stock options, which aligned the interest of managers with shareholders. So now managers were interested not in just maximizing the size of this firm, not in just growing it for the sake of growing it, not in manipulating accounting numbers, but in actually creating wealth, actually increasing the stock value, shareholder value of the company. And that's a consequence of stock options. Now, stock options have fallen out of favor, I think, tragically. And you know, we'll talk about the beginning of the decline of American corporations, partially as a consequence of that, but because of other things as well. Now, one company bucked this trend of divestment, of breaking up the conglomerate. And that company was GE, General Electric. General Electric makes dozens of different things, has a dozen or more units. And during the 1980s, GE got a new CEO, a CEO who had come through the ranks, by the name of Jack Welch. And Jack Welch, it turns out, looking at the history of it, Jack Welch turned out to be one of the great CEOs in American history. He was one of these rare people who could actually manage a conglomerate, who could actually manage many, many units in a company. And part of what he did was hire great managers for each one of those units. One of the things that was part of his genius was he sold up. He got rid of any unit that was not performing very quickly. You had to be in the top. Otherwise, you got cut, you got slashed, he had no problem laying people off. He had no problem cutting units. He had no problem completely 100% being focused on one thing and one thing only. And that is creating wealth. And that is maximizing shareholder wealth. That was his sole focus. He didn't let anything else distract from that. And the stock performance of GE was astounding. It way outperformed the indexes. It had performed almost any other company during that period from around 1981 until 2001, where he left the company. In 2001, the stock had gone down because the whole market had gone down, but it was still way, way, way up. I think it was 4 or 5x when he had taken the company over. And this is pretty rare. This is pretty rare for a company that size to grow that big. And we're not talking about a technology company. Now, part of that was he got into finance, GE Financial, which later took a real beating during the financial crisis. But GE Financial, I don't know if it would have taken the beating if Jack Welch had still been around during the financial crisis. But he was a ruthless, effective, admirable CEO who was a genius and could manage every aspect of this massive conglomerate. Very unusual. He's still alive. You can find his books. He's written a number of books about his experiences, about his management philosophy. I highly recommend them. When you read his books and when you see what made it work, it's really, at the end of the day, the objective is virtues. It's rationality. It's think. It's evaluate. It's judge constantly. And always the facts. Always the facts. Don't tell me what I want to hear. I don't want to hear what I want to hear. Don't tell me the good news. Tell me what's actually going on in the company. Tell me the facts, the truth. And be ruthless. If something is not working, then figure out why. And if you can't fix it, get rid of it. Get rid of it. Again, logic, reason, rationality, honesty, integrity. People loved working for Jack Welch. And a lot of the people that worked for Jack, a lot of the CEOs of the various units, the heads of the various units, later became incredibly successful CEOs at Boeing, Chrysler, and many others. Actually, if you ever listen to my investment course that I did during the 90s, one of the investment strategies that I recommend was investing in companies run by Jack Welch protégés. Now, that, of course, doesn't work anymore because they're all kind of retired or it's all being priced. But actually, if you look back and you look at stock market performance of companies taken when a Jack Welch protégé takes over a company, the company outperforms everything. So you would have done very well if you'd gone in and invested as soon as an announcement was made with the Jack Welch protégé. Now, there were a few exceptions. Home Depot, probably the biggest one. Home Depot was a big mistake. They hired, I forget his name, but they hired a guy who was one of Welch's protégés. Actually, the guy was supposed to take over GE after Jack Welch. But he shifted from a manufacturing CEO to a retail CEO, which is what Home Depot is, and was not good at it, But he was paid a huge signing bonus because he was considered the best hire at the time in terms of the best prospect CEO at the time. This is about 2001, I think. So not only was Jack Welch phenomenal, he trained a bunch of phenomenal people under him. Anyway, come 2001 and Jack Welch retires, a decision has to be made about replacing him. And the GE board, given all the different businesses that they had, Nadelli was the guy who went to Home Depot. I think that's right. And I think he was truly a great manufacturing CEO. I just think the skill set did not translate to retail. He also came in at a time where Home Depot and retail was taking a beating because it was during the early 2000s. Anyway, it's hard to tell. I haven't studied what exactly happened in there. But yeah, thanks, Jonathan, for reminding me of his name. So the board of GE had to decide what kind of CEO they wanted. Jack had been ruthless and had come under a lot of criticism. The social justice, they didn't call them social justice warriors in those days, but shareholders, activists of various kinds, unions, they all hated Jack Welch, in spite of the fact that he made everybody huge amounts of money. The fact that he laid off a lot of people, the fact that he was so outspoken, so ruthless, and pro free markets. Generally, I mean, not a 100% capitalist, but a good guy when it comes to free markets. And they had to decide what they wanted. And given the nature of GE businesses, given the fact that many of the companies that GE ran were in heavily regulated industries, from the GE Capital all the way to nuclear power plants to even jet engines, all of these are heavily regulated, oil and gas, all of these are heavily regulated industries. They decided to go with a CEO who wasn't the most ruthless, but was the most political, knew how to schmooze, knew how to get along with politicians, knew how to be friends with the right kind of people. Right. All right. This is a choice they faced. You could hire a real CEO, or you could hire a schmoozer, a CEO. And I've long contended that one of the real unseen costs of regulation is the quality of the CEOs who today run American businesses. And that the more regulations you impose on a business, the more likely it is that the CEOs running those businesses are not going to be business CEOs, but political CEOs. They're not going to be people who can run a business, maximize shareholder wealth, create wealth. They are going to be people who are good at manipulating the politics, or schmoozing with regulators. You know, one of the things that you would note if you look back at history of Enron is that the CEO of Enron probably spent more time schmoozing with the Bushes in Texas and going to cocktail parties and gaining political allies than he did actually running the company. And of course, that's a company that went bankrupt, and he was accused of fraud and all kinds of other things. So it didn't help him. It hurts dramatically. And that's what happens. So what GE did in 2001 was elect Jeff Immelt as CEO. And I, from day one, said this was going to be a disaster. Immelt was not a Jack Welch. Immelt was a politician. Immelt was a schmoozer. Immelt was a compromiser. He loved Washington, D.C. more than he loved corporate headquarters. He was very friendly with the Bush administration. He was particularly friendly with the Obama administration. And, you know, he got GE, he made GE the politically correct company. He made it, you know, friendly to workers. He made it friendly to environmentalist causes. He tried to appease everybody. He was a nice guy. And today there was a story in the Wall Street Journal about the consequences. He left GE at the end of last year, and one of his proteges took over. And since then, the stock has tanked. But the fact is that since Immelt took over the company, the stock had been down. It had tanked, recovered a little bit, tanked again, slowly recovered, but basically treaded water in spite of a successful stock market during that period. So he did nothing as compared to Jack Welch's massive wealth creation. He did nothing. So Immelt was a complete financial disaster. And since he left, they're discovering that GE is in much worse shape than they thought. And the stock is tanking even further. And now federal regulators are actually looking at some shady accounting that might have been going on at GE. Now, you know, you never know with regulators, and you never know with what they mean by shady accounting. But there's an article today in the Wall Street Journal, fascinating article, how Jeffrey Immelt's success theater masked the rot at GE. Now, here they focus primarily on his management style, which is quite interesting because he was the opposite of Welch. He was not ruthless. He was a get-along kind of guy. He was an optimist. See, he always projected confidence, but never met the numbers he projected. Always stuck to them in spite of not meeting them. So reality was not his guide. He placed his wishes, he placed his whims above reality. And I think the board of GE should be fired to the man. I think they should all be fired. They should be sued for malpractice. Well, you can't sue them for malpractice. But shareholders should demand that every single one of the board members of GE be fired. Now, there's a reason why the GE board is so pathetic. It's because it's got so many what are called independent outside directors. You know, one of the things in corporate governance in the last 30 years was to bring in independent directors who are not beholden to the company, are not from the industry, don't have any expertise. Yeah. So bring in ignorant people to be on the board. And that's exactly what Jeff Immelt did. So you've got a bunch of people on the board of GE who shouldn't be on any board. You know, academics, maybe even politicians, people from industries that have no relationship to the industries that GE is in, people who are ignorant about how to run a company like GE. Those are called independent outside directors. And corporate, the equivalent of social justice warriors in the corporate world, love these kind of things. They love these kind of directors. If you listen to the show I did about corporate social responsibility, you should listen to that show. I talk a lot about these issues with the board of directors. I talk about the famous letter written by T.J. Rogers to the nuns who demanded that he put women on the board. So go back and find that. It's about social corporate responsibility and shareholder wealth maximization. It's a really good podcast. Also, I would suggest that that you listen to a course I did on the corporation, also available as a podcast on Blog Talk Radio, on iTunes, on Stitcher. It's the corporation. I think it's in four or five parts, maybe four parts, about an hour each. It just lays out my views on corporations, on the corporate entity, on the history of corporations. It gets into a lot of this kind of stuff. So Jeff Immelt, his management style was exactly the opposite of Welch's, unfocused on reality, unfocused on truth, unfocused on results, placing wishes above reality, and the fact that he wasn't called on it. He managed this company for 17 years, 16 years, and he wasn't called on it because he was the man in Washington. You know, Washington loved him. Obama loved him. Bush administration loved him. So it's truly pathetic. You know, somebody's asking, why didn't Jack Welch choose his successor? He wasn't allowed to. The board wouldn't allow him. He would have not chosen Immelt. It's obvious he would have not. I think he said so. But the board makes that kind of decision. It's not you who necessarily makes that kind of decision. I think he had another candidate in mind. Okay. Now somebody's accusing me of too much ass kissing of CEOs. I am a huge admirer of CEOs. And look, you can argue that, oh, the rest of their lives, they're messes in the rest of their lives. Really? You know that and you can evaluate that? Plus, these are the geniuses. These are the hardworking, amazing people that keep the American economy going that all of us are benefiting from. Without CEOs, without successful CEOs at these large corporations, right? Where would the American economy be? Where would your job be? Where would all the fun things that you like to buy be? What would your cost of living? What would your standard of living be? I mean, I have massive respect. These are hardworking, incredibly productive, wealth-creating individuals. And they get so much satisfaction, or at least could get so much satisfaction, if they weren't taught to feel guilty that they are some of the happiest people in the world to claim that they are messed up in the rest of their lives. I mean, what, because they get divorced or whatever? I don't know. You don't know that? And a lot of the tragedy about CEOs is that they're made to feel guilty for the wealth that they create, for all the money they made on stock options, for example. Now he's saying I should calm down. See, people, you piss me off and then you demand I calm down. It's not an issue about me. It's an issue about CEOs. You know the reason I get angry is because the huge injustice. There's nothing more important to me than justice. And when you see people working incredibly hard, applying their minds to solving the problem of existence for all of us, because we all benefit from it. I mean, you got to be thankful. Yeah, kiss their ass. Absolutely. You got to love them because they're making our lives better. I love people who make my life better. I love people who make my life better because the standard for what I love is me, is what you do to me. All right, bottom line is a good article in the Wall Street Journal. I recommend it. It doesn't actually name the issues. It doesn't actually name the issues, which is sad. It doesn't talk about Immelt as a politician. It doesn't talk about him schmoozing with Washington. It doesn't talk about his schmoozing with the regulators and how good he was with the regulators. But you get a hint of it. And what it talks about how he presented and how he dealt with facts and the fact that he placed wishes above reality. All right, people asking, the issue isn't their virtue and their work. The issue is, do you judge someone just in one area of life? Well, you certainly judge them in the one area of life that is most important in their career. And second, I don't know about their personal lives. So I don't judge them based on their personal life. I judge them based on what I know. And I judge the, you know, I think it was in, you know, productiveness is such an important virtue that if somebody is incredibly productive, they get huge, you know, benefit of a doubt about everything else from me. So absolutely, if somebody is an incredibly productive person, then if they're screwing up the rest of their life, then I want to go in and help them fix it, because they as a human being are an incredible value to me. And productiveness is such an important virtue, and so rare and so hard at that level, that you got to admire them and you got to respect them and you got to evaluate them positively. I mean, so, you know, business is, I love business. I love business leaders. I love productive people in every realm of life. And if I can see, and even if I can't see, but if I know that they're creating value for me, wow, that you know, I love it. Anyway, in the article, they talk about the fact that Immelt was a polished presenter who held court. Anybody who holds court is suspect. But again, they placed wishes, whims above reality. That always, you know, what did he say? He set unreachable financial target, you know, placed bad bets on markets, the fact that I call it bets, made poor decisions, and didn't change, didn't adapt. Right? Didn't adapt. All right. Brian mentions that there's plenty of mediocrity out there. Yeah, I mean, there is, unfortunately. But I still think that most CEOs are really good. And if they weren't, they would be replaced. You know, the tenure of a CEO today in American corporation is one of the shortest it's ever been. It's 3-4 years because they're kicked out if they don't perform. And yes, there's a lot of mediocrity. That's why they kick them out a lot. But think about all the, you know, all the skill one has to exhibit in order to rise to the top. It's not easy. So I think we're too quick to underestimate. Now, and many of them, by the way, are pragmatists every aspect of their life except in business. And if you read the good business books, people like Jack Welch and others who have written, they're not pragmatic when they talk about what works in business. They're always talking about long-term. They're always talking about thinking. They're always talking about facts and reality. So to be a truly successful business person, over the long run, you're not going to be doing that if you're truly a pragmatist and if you're truly mediocre. Now, again, in heavily regulated businesses, it is true. Then in heavily regulated industries, regulations often shield you from reality. And the more competitive a business, the less regulated it is, the more innovative it is, the more competition there is, the less shielded you are if you are mediocrity. So I'm not saying there aren't such things, but again, if you see somebody successful, value that success and appreciate that success. That's not an issue of generalization. You know, if somebody's created the kind of wealth that Welch has, or the kind of products that a Steve Jobs has, and generally, again, you know, here's a generalization. What can I do? The fact is that the CEOs of most of Americans' big companies, you know, if they don't do a good job, they're going to be out. And to the extent that they're out, yeah, they're mediocrities. So I respect people who take on those jobs. I respect the hard work that's put into it. And I respect the long-term vision that most of these CEOs have to engage in. And you're talking about biotech companies. You're talking about technology companies. You're talking about a wide array of companies. And yes, they're mediocrities and pragmatists. They always are. They usually get weeded out. But the fact is there's a huge shortage in good CEOs. Huge shortage in good CEOs. Jennifer asks, is that what Mitt Romney did by failing companies and fix them? Partially. Private equity does some of that. It also buys companies and just makes them more efficient. It might buy companies from families who maybe not focus so much on the bottom line, but have run a family business for a long time. And then they trim it and make it more productive, more efficient. But the whole point of what Mitt Romney's company did and what private equity generally does is buy private companies, sometimes public, but often private companies, make them much more efficient, much more productive, and much more profitable, much more wealth creating, and then sell them either to other private entity equity players or ideally in the public markets. Although that's happening less and less again because of regulations. All right. We're gonna shift topics here. If you're interested in this, I mean, we'll be doing management and business type stuff once in a while. I just find it interesting. I've got a background, obviously, in finance. I used to teach this stuff, at least from a financial perspective. And I'm a huge admirer of business generally. All right. Let's see. Let's go to this topic that I know very little about. I was just reading about it. I just find it fascinating. I thought I'd bring it to your attention. I think it's kind of interesting. It's called biohacking. Biohacking. Now, biohacking seems to have really exploded with this new technology called CRISP. CRISP is a technology that allows you fairly simply to edit genes in the DNA. So it is a way to edit genes. By the way, somebody's asking about Jack Welch and Atlas Shrugged. I'm pretty sure Jack Welch has read Atlas Shrugged. I'm pretty sure he has said that he's read it and likes it. But I'm not 100% convinced, but I think yes. Anyway, biohacking. So these are people who are basically using this technology and just trying all kinds of crazy stuff. They're editing genes. They're changing genes. And they're trying to cure diseases. They're trying to do all kinds of stuff. Now, it's hard to tell from what I've read how many of them are legitimate and how many of them are just wackos just experimenting with stuff and playing around, not really knowing what they're doing. There have been a number of cases recently where people have been on stage publicly injecting themselves with genetically modified substances, genetically modified genes. There was one that did it recently. You know, they've talked about doing it with HIV. This was another disease. He literally took down his pants and injected himself in public, live streamed to a lot of people in order to increase exposure to this idea of biohacking. Now, what's fascinating about this is that I think this is kind of become this scammy kind of place where people are selling all kind of tools to do this. So this one guy this guy actually injected his arm with DNA encoding that theoretically would enhance his muscles. Now, nobody actually believes it'll do that. He doesn't even believe it'll do that. But that's what he claims he did, right? He live streamed this, and it was a huge, I guess, the biohacking conferences now. And the whole thing is kind of going off the rails, and people are trying to, I mean, this guy, the same guy, has a kit that he's selling to make glow-in-the-dark beer. I guess you change the, you change something, you, I guess it's, beer has living organisms in it, right? So I guess you change that, and they glow in the dark, and the FDA is fighting with him about this, and it's become this big issue, right? Now, somebody injected himself with the untested HIV treatment. There's a company claiming that they have gene therapy for lactose intolerance. Now, none of this has been tested. No lab tests. They just hypothesize these are the genes that are responsible for lactose intolerance. They go in, they edit them, and they say, here, we've got something. Now, this is pretty nutty stuff and pretty crazy. And unfortunately, is going to risk, I think, creating a bad view of this whole CRISP technology, which could be a revolutionary, life-saving, life-enhancing, life-prolonging technology. And of course, part of the problem here is that we don't have any standards for what is real science and what is real testing. The standards are all set by the FDA, and the FDA is a government bureaucracy. And part of the reason these people are injecting themselves in public is to kind of snub at the FDA. These are kind of libertarian, anarchist types who want to say no to the FDA. And of course, what we really want is to get rid of the FDA and have some market-driven alternatives to the FDA that actually set standards and actually set testing standards and actually set a threshold for when something is legitimate and when it isn't, right? And so this is kind of the FDA is going to shut all this down. I'm sure of it. And of course, when the FDA shuts it down, they're going to throw out the water, the baby with the bathwater. They're going to throw out the good stuff with the wacky, nutty stuff. This is another example of regulations create these little bubbles where people are supposedly free, but because they're going to abuse this stuff, and they are, they're already abusing it from what I've read, the FDA is going to shut it all down in order to protect us from the abusers supposedly, but really this is just an excuse to shut a whole industry down. And it really will be tragic because I'm sure that among these companies that are called biohackers, there's some really good companies, some really good scientists, some people doing really good work trying to really revolutionize this area of gene therapy, trying to revolutionize the way in which we treat diseases, in which we treat cancer, in which we treat even life extension and things like that. And, you know, the FDA is not interested in science. The FDA is not interested in patents. The FDA is not interested in any of this stuff. The FDA is interested in covering its own behind. The FDA is interested in minimizing risk. That is the primary of the FDA, and keeping quiet the lobbyists. I mean, the FDA is much more likely to approve cancer drugs because cancer has pressure groups, and it's much less likely to approve other drugs, let's say drugs related to pain, because the people who suffer from chronic pain have not organized a pressure group to go and complain and to create a lot of political mayhem for the FDA. So the FDA, to a large extent, does two things. Some of the people in the FDA, I'm sure, are good people and who are truly interested in the science and truly interested in finding good cures and so on. But most of them are just horrible bureaucrats who want to mitigate, keep their job by mitigating the risk of the drugs that they release out there. And second, they want to appease the pressure groups. They want to appease the political pressure. Now, somebody online is saying cancer drugs don't work. I mean, that's just blatantly not true. Cancer drugs don't work all the time. Cancer drugs don't work on all cancers, but mortality from cancer has gone way down because of the cancer drugs that exist out there. Survival rates from cancer are going way up, and they're going to accelerate in the future. There's a lot of good stuff coming down the pipeline in terms of cancer, but there's already a lot of stuff out there in terms of cancer. So I've researched cancer drugs, and it's just not true that they don't work. You know, some treatments work, some treatments don't. Some treatments work on some cancers and don't work on other cancers. But if you look at the overall statistics, since we've started treating cancer with these drugs, people are living longer and living significantly longer because of these treatments. Now, we're still far off from curing cancer, but there's a lot of interesting drugs in the pipeline. And if the FDA wasn't in the way, we would have a lot of interesting drugs. There are also a lot of interesting drugs which could help people on the verge of dying. And of course, the FDA won't approve it, even for people that are going to die anyway, which is just completely irrational. But again, the group of people that are dying anyway is not a large enough group to put pressure on the FDA to change these kind of laws. This is all pressure group politics. This is what happens when you have an FDA type of thing. All right, I'm not going to argue this cancer issue. You know, it's just not true. It's just you're just unfortunately being misled with the data. All right, so biohacking, kind of interesting, something to watch how the FDA responds to. All right, we're kind of running out of time. Let's see, what did I want to talk about? I'm going to leave gender equality for another time because it's a complex issue. Just quickly, two things. Today, it looked like they were floating a trial balloon out of the Trump administration with the idea of maybe raising gas taxes so that to fund the infrastructure project. Now, I have to say that if the government is going to provide infrastructure, then a gasoline tax is the way to go, some kind of transportation tax. That is, that the people who use the infrastructure, or an airport tax, for example, should be the ones paying for the infrastructure. However, the best way to do that, in the case of airports, it's easy, just privatize them all. In the case of highways and so on, if we're not quite ready to privatize them, at least get the federal government out of it. There's absolutely zero reason why the federal government should do it. And the states already have a gasoline tax. And at the state level, they should determine, do we need new infrastructure? Do we need dramatic improvement to our infrastructure? And then propose an increase in taxes based on that, on gasoline taxes. But even if you do that, I would still hope that they would cut spending somewhere else, cut taxes somewhere else to mitigate the negative impact. But ain't going to happen. You know, this is all just, I mean, the fact that Trump would propose this after supposedly cutting taxes, you know, why not cut spending? What a revolutionary thought. How about shrinking government? That would really drain the swamp if you want to drain the swamp. But of course, this administration has no intention, no incentive to drain the swamp, no interest in draining the swamp. They are the swamp. All right. Finally, quickly on Turkey. We talked a lot about Syria. Again, I don't believe the U.S. should intervene in Syria. I don't think we have any business there. I think we should let the Israelis have free hand to do what they need to do in order to protect themselves from what's going on in Syria. But I would note that Turkey is a member of NATO, as is the United States. And if Turkey is attacking U.S. allies, the Kurds in Syria, Turkey is also seems to be aligning itself with Iran. Now, up until 2-3 years ago, Turkey viewed Iran as a mortal enemy. Turkey is Sunni, Iran is Shiite. Turkey was aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood, aligned with the so-called Arab Spring. Turkey, quick history of Turkey. We got 2 minutes for history of Turkey. After World War I, Turkey used to be a caliphate, used to you know, be the Islamist caliphate. And it lost World War I. It sided with Germany. It could have stayed neutral. It could have stayed out of the war, and it decided to side with Germany. It lost the war, Its territories were occupied by the British and French and the Allied forces. And as a consequence, the Ottoman Empire was broken up. And there was a rebellion against the leadership in Turkey by military officer by the name of Atatürk. And Atatürk basically took over Turkey and became the ruler, the authoritarian ruler of Turkey in, I can't remember, I think it was 1920, just after World War I, maybe 20, maybe 19, maybe 21, that area. Atatürk went then on to basically cleanse Turkey from its Islamist past. So he basically killed all the leading clerics, all the leading Islamic clerics. He basically banned wearing burqas or even headscarves in public in the capital of Turkey. And he completely established a separation of church and state and determined that in the constitution of Turkey, it said that if a government rose in Turkey that threatened the separation of church, Islam, and state, the military should overthrow the government and establish military rule. So the military was charged with protecting the secular nature of the Turkish state. Now, about 15 years ago, 16 years ago, a guy named Erdogan became, and his political party became the leaders of Turkey. Erdogan was a closet or not so closet Islamist, a believer in Islam playing a role in the politics of Turkey, in the politics of the world. And he has over the last 20 years, 15, 20 years, slowly eliminated the separation of state from church. He has slowly taken over more and more and more centralized control over the state of Turkey. He has neutered the role of the military. He has neutered the role of the Supreme Court in Turkey, which used to be secular. He's basically eradicated the secular nature of the Turkish establishment. Turkey generally has become an ally of the Islamists. For a while there, they were helping ISIS in Syria until they realized ISIS wanted their throats as well. And Turkey has gone from a secular ally of the United States to an Islamist country or a semi-Islamist, a almost Islamist country with sympathies to Islamist groups all over the world, from Hamas and to other Sunni groups. As I said, they were aligned with ISIS for a while. So I have no sympathy for Turkey, particularly in its conflict with the Kurds. The Kurds, at least for right now, are relatively speaking for that region of the world, pro-freedom, pro-rights, and pro-America, pro-our interests versus other interests. So I am much more pro-Kurds than I would be right now, pro-Turkish. And Turkey has drifted away, completely away, from Europe and from the United States. For a while, Europe was considering adding Turkey to the European Union. Given what Erdogan has done, they have rescinded that idea. They, and I think that's a good thing. They don't need Turkey in the European Union. They ask one of the questions: why have the Turkish citizens and military allowed? The military's tried to stop it on a number of occasions. You saw an attempted coup just about a year and a half ago, right? And that Erdogan crushed ultimately. And I think the reason is that the Turkish citizens have always been more religious than the political establishment wanted, or the political establishment determined. So Atatürk did not change the nature of the Turks. He didn't change their philosophy. He didn't change their thinking. He didn't establish an enlightenment. He didn't bring in Western ideas. He only brought in Western political ideas without the more fundamental ideas. This is a whole argument from objectivism, that you have to change the philosophy in order to get the politics and the economics. And if you don't change the philosophy, if you don't have an enlightenment, you can't get America. You don't get the founding fathers. And even if you got the founding fathers, America doesn't survive. It doesn't survive 20, 30 years. The reason America got established, the reason the founding fathers succeeded, the reason the experiment survived is because you had a shift in the philosophy, which happened during the Enlightenment. That never happened in Turkey. So Turkey's population was always religious. And after 1979 is a key year for the rise of Islam and rise political Islam or Islamism or jihadism, however you want to call it. Because 1979 is the year that Iran succeeded in turning from a secular country under the Shah to an Islamist country under Ayatollah Khomeini. And whether you were Sunni or Shia, it didn't matter. You took inspiration from that. And when you look at all the Sunni groups and their writings, from the Al-Qaeda leadership to the Muslim Brotherhood leadership to the Erdogan, to the leadership of Islamist groups as far away as Indonesia, they all took inspiration from what happened in Iran. So from 1979, the Turks looked at Iran and said, hey, we can do that. And we can do it better. We don't have to be secular. Our culture is not secular. We don't really believe in the secular stuff. That's for those people in Ankara. That's not for us in the heartland. We want to go back to the roots. We want to go back to basics. And they have elected Erdogan, and Erdogan is incredibly popular and has been incredibly popular in Turkey since. But this is part of the problem of the way NATO is structured today. NATO doesn't have a purpose. NATO doesn't have a mission. NATO is an alliance with no uniform value system. This is one of the reasons I think we shouldn't be a part of NATO, and not so we are not in the same alliance, military alliance with Turkey, because I don't believe we share that much with Turkey as it is comprised today. You know, again, before Erdogan, different story. But today, Turkey is aligning itself because of what's going on in Syria, because of American weakness, because of no American vision, no American leadership, no American articulation of the American values and American and what the American project is and what the American policy is. No America first foreign policy, just a mishmash of nothings. Basically, Turkey has decided that it's better off to side with the winners. And the winners in Syria and the winners in the Middle East right now are not the United States. They're not even Saudi Arabia. The winners in the Middle East right now are Iran and Russia. And Turkey is aligning himself with the two enemies of the United States, or potential enemies, one real enemy, one potential enemy, Iran and Russia. And this is really, really dangerous, given that we have no foreign policy and we don't know what we're doing in the world. The world is only going to be more dangerous and more of a disaster over the coming years as the U.S. foreign policy continues to flounder and go nowhere, absolutely nowhere. All right, we're out of time. I've kind of blocked only an hour for this show, so we're gonna stick to that. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope it's educational. You know, a lot of these topics are massive, and we have to cover them very quickly, but we'll get back to Turkey. The Middle East is not going away. We're going to continue to be discussing it in the years to come. We've got a show tomorrow with Bradley Thompson. We're going to be talking to him about school shootings, private education, and the Clemson Institute for Capitalism and its Lyceum program. I will talk to you then, and then I'm back with Amy on Saturday. All right. Talk to you soon. Bye, everybody.